Sorry to be late. I was asked to clarify my position on one issue. I've said publicly before, and I'll repeat again, I strongly oppose school vouchers for students who attend private schools. I said that publicly a couple of times this session, and I'll repeat it now so everyone, including legislators who asked that I clarify my position, are very clear. I will veto any bill that has vouchers attached to it. With that, I'll throw it open to questions.
Can you define what you consider vouchers?
What's in the House bill. I mean, this is well-trod territory. I've seen this come before me in 2000. Either 11 or 12 or maybe both, and then again, it was in the House bill in 2015, didn't make the final cut, but we discussed it in those meetings, and then for years before, I think public money should go for public education.
Governor, are you referring specifically to the pre-K provisions or beyond?
Well, pre-K, I put it in a separate category. The pre-K money goes to I support pre-K money. It would go to schools for setting up their pre-K programs. You know, the existing recipients, so which should be include charter schools, not private. But the the child care credits, the money that goes for the parents to help afford the CCAP, all those things, you know, go to private providers. So I make a distinction there.
Would the early learning scholarship that House Republicans are talking about be in that same category?
I support the early childhood scholarships. I say it's not either or, it's both or all of the above. It's child care assistance, both the tax credit that's been in my my proposal now for the last 3 years or 2 years, and as well as the CCAP funding and also the money to help parents with those costs, which are very high. If somebody's 3 or 4 year old, if somebody's 4 year old child is doing well in a child care facility, then great. And then places that don't have those child care facilities, don't have quality ones, according to the rating system, and whose only alternative would be a pre-K program through the local school, then I support that. I think what's important is what's best for the kids, not what is suits somebody's political ideology or somebody's business interest. What really ought to drive this discussion is what's best for kids, and both of them are good for kids. And both of them should be supported.
I wanted to clarify, are you talking about the tax bill provision?
Yeah.
To give a tax break to donations that would...
Well, we give a tax break to donations. I mean, that's a concern I have. There are two, as I understand, there are two pieces to the tax proposal. One is a voucher, a reduction in, whether through the taxes or through a credit. But the other is giving a state credit in addition to the state and federal tax deductions for contributions to charitable organizations, which exists on the books now. So if you said, well, we're going to give the normal tax deductions for a charitable contribution to a foundation, and we're also going to add this additional one, the line would be down to Snelling very quickly. Of all the other worthwhile organizations, hunger organizations and you name it, domestic violence organizations who say, well, we deserve that kind of special consideration as well. So that's my concern about that. I encourage people to make contributions to foundations for a variety of worthwhile purposes. One of them certainly could be providing for private or especially parochial education. But I just think we're going down a steep slope if we start providing special credit for, in addition to what we've done already.
Governor, back to pre-K, in the bill that they have proposed, they're moving a lot of money to those early scholarships, $26.9 million, I believe, in the House. And they issued a statement saying that this essentially defunds pre-kindergarten. Do you really believe that that's what it does? And would you accept a bill with that form of funding?
Well, I believe that's the intent. They're wholly harmless. They're going to transfer the money for the first, I think it's 1 or maybe it's 2 years, but then the money stops. So, yes, they're transferring the money out of pre-K programs, which is just totally unacceptable. And I hope the House recognizes that. It's one of the reasons why the House and Senate need to reconcile their bills and the policy matters before we sit down and do our final negotiations. I mean, they just, it's not warranted by the facts. There's all sorts of evidence from people all over the state, kindergarten teachers who get the benefit of five-year-olds who had a year of pre-K before, pre-K teachers themselves, parents, you know, who think that this program has been a miracle worker for their kids as a good quality childcare. You know, it's not about one or the other, it's about both. I have a woman on my staff who leaving for a leave shortly to join the training for the National Guard. She grew up in Texas, right on the Mexico border. So I'm guessing maybe 20 years ago, she had Texas provided all day pre-K, all day kindergarten, and free breakfast and lunches, all publicly funded. Texas, you know, we consider ourselves better than some of these other states with our education policies. We're behind. There are other states that have less per capita income and less resources available to them than we do, who said this is a priority. Priority, we give every four-year-old child what he or she needs to be successful. And get the adults out of the way, get the political ideology out of the way, get the business self-interest out of the way, and ask ourselves one question, what's best for the kids? And it's not the same for everybody.
So that's a no-go. You won't accept the bill with
that. It's going to eliminate pre-K? No. I mean, we have, I don't recall right now the numbers, but you know, we fully subscribed, oversubscribed this year for pre-K, and next year, more than double the applicants, the school districts themselves. I mean, that's a test right there. They want it. They recognize the benefits of it. Their teachers recognize the benefits of it. I recognize the benefits of it. Well, I've said I understand why, you know, citizens in Appleton and that immediate area want to see the prison reopened and reestablished. You know, it's given that they're cutting funding for everything else, I don't know how they can justify the additional cost of purchasing, rehabilitating, and then operating that prison, which Commissioner Roy says is not necessary at this point in time. So it's fiscally unwise, and it's not, again, I defer to the Commissioner of Corrections that it's not at this point needed.
So you're not continuing the discussions at this point?
I haven't had discussions this session. I may have had one at the end of the last session. I've had this discussions to make myself aware of the situation, but I haven't had any discussions, and I haven't been asked for discussions this session.
Other questions? So, during this hour, the Senate Finance Committee is debating and will vote on another abortion-related bill. The Minnesota House a couple of nights ago passed two of them. It looks like they're headed for your desk. What's your view on that?
Well, I don't know the specifics of it, but the way you described them, and I believe they're parallel to the ones I vetoed previously. I'll veto them again. Well, I think it was, you see a lot of the, along with the various other policy issues we've been discussing here and I've been discussing, I think you see the right wing of the Republican, particularly House GOP caucus, speaking to their base and putting themselves on record in support of things that they must know I'm not going to find acceptable and never agree to, but it serves their purpose to highlight the differences. And, you know, there's legitimacy to that. I mean, the Democrats do that too. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but they want to go on record, and now the Senate as well. But this, you know, issue again has been, and I suppose they're also encouraged by, you know, what's happening in Washington. But my position remains the same.
Yesterday, Speaker Dell came out of the meeting with you and called you irresponsible and unengaged. Do you have any reaction to that?
Well, I've been engaged since I submitted a budget in January and amended it after the next forecast. I've been in two meetings the last 5 days with the Speaker and Majority Leader. I've sent 190 pages of letters describing in detail, great detail, what I agreed with and what I disagreed with in their respective budget bills. So, I mean, I think it's unfounded to say that I'm not engaged. I'm right here, and once they finish their job, which is to reconcile their bills from both a policy and a budget standpoint, then I'm fully ready to sit down here and negotiate the final resolution. But if they have significant differences between themselves, both on policy and on budget, and I've said, you know, that they need to reconcile those differences before we sit down. Well, they want to do it. They don't want to have to bring them to the floor again. Semi-bills, I'm going to veto, they say. We'll see about that, but I mean, that's what they say. And so I'm, you know, I'm willing to accommodate that and shorten the time frame. And, you know, and Senator Gazelka very sincerely wants to resolve matters in a collegial way. And I'm certainly, you know, supportive of that. So I think once they finish the conference reports, and once they're all completed, so we can, again, have MMB verify that their numbers are valid, and we have apples-to-apples comparison with my budget, then we'll be in a position to sit down and talk. And as soon as they're ready, I'm here.
You said a few weeks ago that you were confident that Gazelka did want to resolve this in an amicable way. You said the proof was in the pudding on Speaker Gallup. Have you seen that pudding yet?
No, the pudding's still in the oven. We'll know at the end. I mean, we have very honest differences. I mean, very honest differences on policy. We have very honest differences on budget priorities. And, it's going to be challenging to reconcile those differences at the very end. We've got to do it. So we will do it. But no one should imagine why it's going to be easy. They've been here for 4 months. You know, they had ample time to get all their reports, conference reports, finished and passed by the conference committees. I mean, I don't dictate their timetable. They have that within their own control. We still have 3.5 weeks left to go, and if they get their conference reports concluded, and if the numbers add up, then we're in a position to begin with 3 weeks still remaining, and that's ample time to get to resolve our differences.
Well, Governor, at the risk of going down a rabbit hole with this stuff, the Speaker of the House says that you sent a letter to the Republican leader saying you wanted joint targets by this coming Friday, and now you're changing the parameters of your requests and requirements.
Well, I sent that letter 6 weeks ago. I sent a letter April 17th to clarify, and that was inarticulately expressed in the March 13th letter. You know, and I've clarified verbally to them two or three different meetings, what my position is, which is stated in my subsequent letter, was April 17th. So, you know, this is not a game of gotcha. This is a game of it's a very important exercise in resolving our differences, and to hang an accusation on one sentence 6 weeks ago, which has been clarified and restated, however you want to phrase it. You know, it's just, it's by the boards.
Just so we understand, so you didn't mean exactly what you wrote on that?
Well, it was sort of the political, you know, we said joint conference committee targets no later than Friday, April 28th. I mean, I've clarified that to say they need to set their joint targets, the House and Senate. You know, the way the Constitution is written, both the federal and state, we have legislature is a bicameral body. And they're an independent, co-equal branch of government, but they have to, under the Constitution, join together and come to their own single position before they establish that position. And so that's what I'm asking or insisting that they do. And I didn't express it properly in 6 weeks ago, but I've expressed it the way I want to express it since that time.
Governor, just so I want to be sure I'm absolutely clear. When they finish their conference report and the conferees sign off, not necessarily to the floor at that point, then that is when you believe that it would be appropriate for you to get involved and engage in the negotiations.
After they're all passed, so we know what they add up to, and after MMMB has vetted and said that we have an apples-to-apples comparison between my budget proposals, which I've submitted, which had to add up to a balanced budget, and theirs, and then we have a common basis on which to begin to negotiate. And we had discussions yesterday and talked about the legacy bill. We talked some about transportation in terms of some of the issues there. I mean, we're having those conversations in these meetings now, but I'm not going to sit down and agree to final allocations of money. You know, their two tax bills, if you take what they want to move out of the general fund for transportation, dedicated to transportation, and the House tax bill is over the surplus. The Senate is very close to that, and they have other things that they want to do. So, I mean, that's why, again, they're in a difficult point in the process where they have to reconcile, as I had to back in January, everything that they'd like to do with what is available. So I understand the pressures that they're facing right now, but you know that's the way the process works.
I regret to join Kessler in the rabbit hole, but after they're all passed, you want them to complete their conference committee reports, pass them on the floor, and then you'll get there?
Well, no, not pass them on the floor, because I mean, that's their preference. Excuse me. At least that's Senator Gazelka's preference, that they not go through the exercise of passing them on the floor and then sending me bills and say if I veto them, then going back. And that, you know, takes up a certain amount of time. So their preference is that after they sign the conference committee reports and we have them all lined up and we can do, again, the comparisons I've been describing, at that point, they don't have to go to the floor. We can negotiate them.
And why require the signing of the conference committee report? Wouldn't you just like joint targets between the House and the Senate before you
read? Well, the targets are generally defined. I mean, the targets are going to set, you know, general numbers for transportation or for, you know, human services. But there are all sorts of details that are in those conference reports, as they're in the House and Senate bills now, which really define, you know, the elements of those targets, and also contain a lot of, you know, disagreements we have. I mean, setting joint targets is going to be challenging enough for the House and Senate to reconcile their differences. It's going to be extremely difficult for that report, that final set of reports and mine, to be reconciled, because we have very sincere differences in priorities of, you know, pre-K versus business tax cuts. You know, those are fundamental differences, and they're going to be difficult to resolve. So get as much clarity as possible on the legislative side before we get into that rabbit hole.
Governor, go back to the Apple thing just for a moment. Looking at it more holistically, the House bill has lots of new, well, I shouldn't say lots, but it's got some new crimes. It's got increased penalties in some areas. Last year, there were drug sentencing reforms that Commissioner Roy said would bring down the bed space. They've also done some reforms that they think would bring down the bed space. Penalties and increased crimes may tend to offset that.
one source I talked to, speaking probably in a little bit of exasperation, said he thinks that the House is just trying to put more people in jail. I'm sure, what is your response to that? Do you in any way agree with that point?
I'm not going to comment on it. I haven't been following the particulars of it. You know, our prisons are very strapped for space. We have, I forget the percentage, but I think it's about 20% of our prisoners for state crimes are in county jails. I mean, that's not a desirable situation. The commissioner, again, thinks we can manage the situation and add a couple of improvements for like Rush City and I think the Lasana Lakes. I don't hold me to those, but there are a couple of modifications that would ease the situation. But the, if the trends continue and we keep putting more people into prisons, then at some point we're going to need another one. But it's his judgment, not this year.
Governor, you mentioned that
at some point we may need another one.
My apologies.
No, I thank you.
You mentioned if you've been talking with leaders about transportation. Has anything come up with some compromises on transit funding for the Met?
Well, we talked about that. I said that's got to be a key element in transportation bill that I'll accept. And Met Council's put a number 80 million. That's 80 million above the House, right? Where's Joanna? 80 million above the House for Dulker. 85 million above the House position or the Senate?
Yeah, above the Senate position and the House.
You should have heard her do a recitation of the agriculture policy issues yesterday. It was stunning. So anyway, whatever the number, whatever Chair Dunnick says is the bottom line they need just to continue present level of service, not to add service or improve it. But I made the point very clearly. I mean, they talked about what they might do with CTIB, dissolve that and free up the counties individually then to add a half-cent sales tax at their own discretion. I mean, I just stress, we have to provide the resources, setting aside a light rail, but our buses are our principal strategy for public transit. We have to provide the Met Council and the counties with the resources to make those investments, to build new bus lines, rapid bus transit, to improve existing service, to upgrade the fleet. I mean, to turn our backs on that is going to force more cars onto already congested metro highways and going to constrict the economic growth of this region in a disastrous way. And I hope they get that message. I hope we can get the politics of rural and metro out of those considerations. And again, do what's right for the people of Minnesota. That's what we're here to do.
Does Southwest Light Rail have to, in some way, shape, or form?
Let it go.
Does Southwest Light Rail, in some way, shape, or form, some ability for that to proceed need to be part of this agreement?
Well, I think there is the ability to proceed right now. And Secretary Chau sent a letter in response to the legislators who wrote her and said, we have to get our act together here. We believe the Met Council has bonding authority, and depending on what happens with CTIB, whether that bonding is routed through the counties or through Hennepin County or through the Met Council remains to be resolved. We have two issues with two of the railroads that they've proven intractable so far with BNSF on the corridor, and what's the other small one?
CTNW.
She does transportation as well as agriculture. And we can't agree on a price for their access. So we get all this stuff batty back and forth. Within the state of Minnesota about pros and cons alike. And if we don't pull our act together and submit a final complete proposal to the federal government this summer, then they'll direct that money to somewhere where they do have that support.
Well, if I may, the reason why I ask that is that the Republicans, at least in the House, are making no bones
I just say to them, show me the alternative. I mean, I can't make it. I can't make the legislature put some in there, but show me the alternative to the Southwest line. Look at a highway map between Eden Prairie and Minneapolis, and where would a rapid bus transit go? You'd have to go on existing highways, 484, 100, 94, 394. You know, so you got to take a lane from those already overcrowded highways and devote them to a rapid bus transit. I mean, there's no viable alternative except to say, okay, all of you get on the highways. Everybody who would ride that line, wants to ride that line, has to get a car and get it on the highways. And we will choke the economic vitality of the metropolitan region if we don't have a good public transit system. And you got to start now to have it 10 years from now and 20 years from now. So it's easy to play politics here and say we're not going to do it and blah, 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 but offering no alternative is just extremely irresponsible and very destructive to the future of this region and therefore the state.
In your meetings with Senator Gazelka, have you discussed any of your policy differences, the school vouchers, any of the other ones that you've already talked about publicly? In those discussions,
No, because there again, exactly, you know, why I want the House and Senate to resolve their differences. I mean, there are stark differences in their bills. So I want to know what the legislature's position is on those matters and others before we begin. So, you know, we've touched on them, but we haven't had any negotiations or serious in-depth discussions about them.
Are there any spending areas where you see fast agreement coming?
Well, they passed the legacy bill, you know, unanimously and almost unanimously. And of course, you know, it's about providing money, so that's usually very popular. And there are some issues, particulars with there that is some of the groups affected by that have concerns about. But I think that one's is doable. If we can work out some of those, iron out some of those details. I mean, the transportation is such a big one and such an important one. I mean, you know, again, if we can get it resolved and we know what the budget parameters are, and I've said to them, you know, if you're going to take $200 million a year out of the general fund and put it dedicated to transportation, then that's $400 million out of the surplus, and you got to recognize that. And they said they did and would. So, I mean, the things that we can get done, I want to get done on time. I want to get done early. Senator Gazelka said he'd have a barbecue at his lake place if we got done the week before the weekend, final weekend. I've never seen that happen, but I'd be delighted to see it happen this time. I'm ready to do anything I can within, you know, again, a measured process to get things resolved.
Was he inviting you to that barbecue?
Well, I invited him to the fishing opener. He and his daughter Lydia are joining me for the fishing opener and as is a speaker. You know, we had great, that was the best fishing I had on an opener was when I had the speaker and then Majority Leader Bach on Lake Vermilion. So I'm hoping this will happen again. And so, the, you know, I expect I would be invited to the barbecue or he wouldn't have brought it up.
Governor, the perennial abortion debate was surfaced again this weekend. Two bills passed, one to license providers. Are those not surfaced for you?
Yeah, I'll veto those. I vetoed them very similar, if not the same, in 2011 or 12, and I'll do it again. I'll veto them again. This is, you know, again, that's just pandering to the base. You know, I mean, let's leave things as they are. But, you know, when these bills come up like this, you know, you just say, okay, they're making their pitch to their base. Well, because they've been serious obstructionists. They're not accountable to anybody. They're not accountable to local governments. They're not accountable to the projects that need to move forward. They grab onto something with almost, you know, at will, and then they just sit on it for as long as they want to do so. And, you know, my chief of staff, who's had to negotiate with them on frustration, could detail some of the particulars, but we had to mayor of, I believe it's Fergus Falls, who will clarify that, but I'm pretty sure, who called to indicate his support, said that he tried to meet with them, some project they're holding up there, and they won't even meet with them. Won't even meet with the mayor of the city. So, I mean, there's just no accountability there. I'm for historic preservation within reasonable bounds, but also with, not just sitting on the process. And so, we're not eliminating it. We're moving it to the Department of Administration, which 48 of the other 50 states put it in the executive branch. So again, there's some accountability. And they'll have the same mission, same statutory responsibilities and authorization, but they'll just have to be accountable to the overall process of the government. I swear I did not even think of that till I saw a recent story. I mean, I don't attribute any of that to them. They were not a prime mover in that disagreement. That was legislators and groups, and I'm a grown up. I can live with. Back when 1980s. I was state auditor to eliminate the office of state treasurer. And they brought it before, actually it was a DFL majority in the House, the DFL Government Reform Committee, and I made my pitch, and I was the treasurer back then, I forget his name, the Dairy Queen guy. Yeah. And so he made his pitch and everything, and they voted my down, and then Majority Leader Ted Winter was sitting next to me in the audience, and he chortled and he gave me the only, he said, "Well, Mark, you sure crashed and burned on that one." And I said, "Yeah, it's happened before, and it'll happen again." And so, that's just the way this process works, and it's supposed to work. So I just absolutely swear that that was not a factor. Because again, I don't attribute that responsibility or whatever you want to call it to them at all. This is about making that office work with the rest of state government on behalf of their interests and other interests for the benefit of the people of Minnesota.
Governor, are the Republicans hearing your message on buffers, or even some Democrats who are saying a lot of farmers are pretty upset about cooking?
Well, certain farmers are upset. They hold a meeting, and the people who are upset show up at the meeting. 75% of the counties are within between 60 and 100% compliance with what's not going to be required until November of this year. The Soil and Water Conservation just put out an advisory for their local districts and for all farmers and other landowners about the flexibility that's provided. Anybody who says it doesn't work in my particular situation can go to their local Soil and Water Conservation District and talk and work that through. So we have made every accommodation possible. Made accommodations after the first round. We made accommodations last year, and various groups signed off on it, said they were satisfied to support the initiative. And now some of those same people, at least some of their members, are back, complaining again. As though it doesn't really matter. As though we're sort of this is sort of a convenience. This is an urgent situation. I mean, they should look at the facts of what the contamination saying to the Minnesota River. Look at that picture where the Minnesota River and the Mississippi River conjoin, and look at the difference in the water quality. I mean, that's just one example of serious contamination of our waters, and agriculture is part of that. Now, I just learned last week that road salt and sand is a factor. So as soon as we get through the legislative session, I intend to sit down with Commissioner Zelli and talk about what do we need to do in the metro area to deal with the same issues. We can't just use our waters as waste repositories. So I just again, I think if you ask the people of Minnesota, do you want clean water? And you believe that what we're doing now is necessary to provide clean water, if they really understand how contaminated it is, they'll overwhelmingly be supportive. What we're talking about with the 25 and 25 is improving water quality so that 25% of the water in Minnesota, one-fourth of the water, is improved from where it is now. If we don't do anything, it's 6 or 7%. So if we don't do nothing like buffers and other measures, 93% of the water is going to just stay the same or get worse by the year 2025. I mean, we're talking about a hidden crisis here, and we got smaller communities who've got to spend millions of dollars to treat their water before the citizens can drink it or use it. Got, you know, rivers and streams and small lakes southwestern Minnesota where there's no aquatic wildlife, fish can't survive. I mean, I'm not making this up. I'm just dealing with it. And the legislature needs to deal with it. And I've said to both of them emphatically, I will not negotiate a buffer bill for this session. I'm not going to agree to any changes. And next year, after the bill has started to take effect in November of this year, and after we have some real life situations, if there are, where things need to be tweaked, then let's look at it then, based on reality, but not based on a continuation of the scare tactics that are being employed by some, by a few. Well, we all have a responsibility. Again, you know, most landowners in rural Minnesota have already taken this initiative. Probably a majority of them took this initiative before I came up with this proposal. You know, we impose on businesses all over the state environmental quality measures, some at their own cost. So I don't think we're treating the industry of agriculture any differently from how we're treating the industry of other enterprises that have some environmental effect. They haven't done it heretofore, so I understand for them it's a change, but it's a long-standing policy going back decades of requiring businesses to make environmental quality improvements. With all due respect to Congressman Olson.
Governor, we can hear your voice that you have a bit of a cold.
The rest of my health is good. I have a cold.
Governor, real ID doesn't seem to have gone anywhere this week. What's the status on that from what you understand?
From what I understand, the Conference Committee is still, you know, has their difference over the House insistence that undocumented immigrant licenses be put into the bill. It has no place in the bill. It's not necessary. I've said that again and again. I have no authority. Department of Public Safety has no authority under existing law to initiate that change.
It doesn't appear that any more meetings are scheduled at the moment, although it's probably the call to chair. Does that concern you, given the time?
Well, it would concern me if we don't pass a bill this session. If we don't pass a bill this session, then people in Minnesota are in serious risk of not being able to get on commercial airlines next January 22nd. Now, I don't want to scare people now because I still believe the legislators recognize that absolute imperative, but that's why, again, the bill's got to get resolved. Just have a clean and real ID bill. That's what it started out to be. It's about satisfying the federal government, and I realize there are legislators who don't like it and those who on principle disagree with it, but this is about satisfying the federal government overreach, whatever you want to call it. But I mean, I think is we want to protect our skies. So, you know, this the bill could be and should be just straightforward on that subject, and all these other areas are really incidental to it and not related to real ID should be set aside for now to get this done. Anything else? I'm going to go blow my nose. Thank you.